he was telling the truth. And they did die. Straight away they died in terms of their relationship with him. They cut themselves off from the author of life. And some years later, physical death caught up with them to confirm that they really were dead. And that is why death is such a fearsome thing. When we die, we are walking into the judgment room of the living God. We can attempt to run from God in this life, but death ensures that all such attempts to flee from him will be proved futile in the next. Death is a problem for the future. And so the temptation for so many people is just to put it off, just to act as if it will not happen. There are plenty of people trying to do that, erasing the telltale signs of our advancing mortality, whether through Botox or ever more sophisticated creams or investigating cryptogenics or just burying themselves in the busyness of life, the pleasures of life, the opportunity for travel and such like. But in the end, to put death off is not actually a solution. Of course, I mean, it's inevitable. Each one of us has contracted, as they say, a sexually transmitted disease with a 100% fatality rate called life, which gives birth to death. It's inevitable. But more than that, the real problem I want to suggest to you this morning is that death is not just tomorrow's issue. It is, in fact, today's issue. And that's why we ought to face up and think about it. For three reasons, at least, it's today's issue. First of all, you simply never know when you're going to die. In our day, we're fairly well aware of how death for many people seems to be a fairly well-controlled process with suitable drugs and good medical care to enable someone to slip out of this world in as comfortable a way as possible. But just because that represents many people's experience, it shouldn't blind us to the fact that we all know people along the course of life who sadly never had that opportunity to make it to a good age. People who never made it to adulthood, or young adults who themselves were cut down in the prime of life, or parents of young children who were never able to raise their own children. Death has this awful ability to reach into this world and to snatch people prematurely and without warning sometimes. I think of a friend of mine at Bible college who was aged 28 when his wife woke up one night in the middle of the night to hear him taking his last breaths. I played with him on the football team. He was a fit young man. And at the post-mortem, they never discovered what happened. There never was any apparent cause of death. Death can come any time and in any place. And every one of us, we are only one heartbeat away from stepping into eternity. So death is not just an issue to be sorted out tomorrow, to be put off to another day. It is today's issue, because we never know when our last day will come. Then secondly, death is today's issue because we are deciding our future now. That is, I think we can have a rather idealistic view of how one day we'll start thinking about the important issue of death when we've got more time to do so, or it's more convenient to do so. You know, oh, I know it's an important topic, and I will get around to it one day, you know, when the exams have finished or kids have grown up or I've got a bit more time or I've retired or whatever it is. You know, we all know people have those deathbed conversions. Maybe I'll be one of those. I'll get around to it. But that line of thinking, it all assumes that we will want to consider spiritual things in the future. But on what grounds do we make such an assumption? Isn't it more true to say that you and I, we humans, are more like slowly setting concrete? You know? I mean, if we've just spent 50 years saying no to God, or 60 years, or 70 years, what makes us think we'll be any different when finally we get to this great age when we've got more time and more freedom? Although, I must say, one of you recently pointed out to me that living in a retirement home, she said, I'm more busy now than I've ever been in my whole life, when you see the social calendar that is put on for us. So maybe we delude ourselves that life will ever be quieter. But even if it was, what makes us think that we will change in our appetite, in our desire? Is it not more true to say that the decisions we make when we're younger are the ones we then pass on to our children and live by and retire by and die by. You know? Some people, of course, change, but actually for most people, change gets harder as we get older. After all, everything you practice, we know this ourselves, everything you practice at and you work at, you actually get good at doing. So if you practice at saying no to God for many decades, you actually get very good at doing it, and it becomes second nature. Death is not tomorrow's issue, when we are less able to make changes than we are today. It is today's issue, while we're still able to make those changes. But a third reason why death is today's issue is because death renders our life meaningless. Across the noblest of our achievements, across the most precious of our relationships and the most worthy of our actions, death puts a great line through them all. Everything that we like to think of as being meaningful in this life, we don't like to think in this way, but the blunt truth is that death takes it away from us. Death wipes it away. I mean, they say, don't they, that the memory of a person, the legacy of a person, lasts for two generations, and then after that is gone. Can you remember the names of your great-great-grandparents? I can't. Good on you if you can, but I bet if you go further back, you can't. There is that verse in the Bible that says we are like the flowers of the field, and the flowers blossom, but then the wind blows over them and they wither and they are gone. And one day, we will be gone as well. And not that long after that, our memories will be gone, our legacy will be gone. So to most people, they just get on and live life for what they can see, putting these things out of their minds. But occasionally, to a thinking person, this is what can drive a person to despair, the realization that in the end, nothing really counted after all. That's what the writer in our Old Testament passage from the book of Ecclesiastes was talking about. He tried to find the meaning of life. He indulged himself with pleasure. He embarked on great projects. He threw himself into a worthy cause like conservation. He went on to accumulate great wealth. Eventually, when he realizes he's not going to derive any ultimate satisfaction from any of those, he turns to philosophy and considers the difference between good and bad people, but then throws his hands up in despair as he reflects on the fact that the same fate overtakes them both. Death always wins in the end. And no wonder, therefore, that some people have found the meaninglessness of life just too much to cope with. Think of a man like Ernest Hemingway. I remember reading him as a child growing up. As a writer in his day, was absolutely unparalleled. Nobel Prize for Literature, Pulitzer Prize in the early 1950s, saw active service in both world wars, traveller, big game hunter, to say nothing of four marriages, I think it was. It was almost as if the virility of his life made up for the barrenness of life on the inside. But in 1961, he took a gun and shot himself. He knew that his best days were over, and it just seemed there was no point living anymore. And that, in the end, is why death is not tomorrow's issue, but today's issue. Without knowing what is beyond death, we don't know what we're supposed to live for in this world. We can't hope to construct a life with ultimate meaning at all. The question is, where do you find an answer for what is beyond this world? That's the problem with death, isn't it? It's like the undiscovered country. It's like the ferry journey to the other side for which they only sell single tickets. No one has ever come back from the dead to tell us what it is like. I mean, there are reports of near-death experiences, but actually someone being dead and coming back, that just doesn't happen. Except, of course, for one person. And this is the extraordinary claim of the New Testament, that Jesus Christ really did die, and that having been dead, he really did come back into this world. And so this morning I just want to offer from the New Testament a couple of simple thoughts for us to consider on this important topic. First of all, there is a new fact the resurrection of Jesus. A new fact in the sense that when Jesus Christ rose from the dead, this world changed forever. No longer was it true to say that no one has come back from the dead. In fact, those opening verses of 1 Corinthians 15 recount what an extraordinary thing had happened that first Easter day when Jesus rose from the dead. The first thing to understand is that it was, in a very real sense, no surprise that Jesus had done so. Because it says in that verse, I don't know if you picked it up there, in 1 Corinthians 15, that Jesus rose from the dead according to the scriptures. That is, God had long predicted that when he came down to earth in the person of the Messiah, he would be recognizable by what he would do. After all, we all have certain expectations of God if he was to appear on earth. You would expect if God came to this earth, he would be able to do some things that you and I were not able to do. We wouldn't expect him to be like everyone else in every way. And by no means the only, but perhaps the most significant sign that would mark out this person when he finally came to this world would be that he would rise from the dead. And I very clearly remember as a non-Christian in the days before following Jesus that I came to a position of having to concede that if someone could raise themselves from the dead, you couldn't really ask for greater evidence that they were God come to earth. I mean, if you won't accept that, what are you asking God to do? What would you want him to do that would convince you? A real resurrection surely is as good as it gets, as distinctive as it gets. So a number of times in the Old Testament, God had predicted this would be the case. And says the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, what was predicted back then has now come to fulfillment. Jesus was not a bolt from the blue. He was in fulfillment. He came in fulfillment of everything that had been said beforehand. And a fulfillment that was not done in a corner, not just seen by a few people. We read in that passage that he appeared to many different people at different times, in different locations, over those first 40 days after he was raised from the dead, including on one occasion by over 500 people at the same time, most of whom, said the Apostle Paul at the time of writing, are still living. In other words, his readers would have been able to go there and to ask them if they'd wanted to. Jesus really had risen. This was not a resuscitation. This was not just a near-death experience. He really had died and really had come back from the dead. Because when the Bible talks about faith, it's not a sort of airy-fairy thing. It's not a mystical quality or a private subjective experience. It is faith in the facts. Facts which were predicted, and then facts which were accomplished in the presence of witnesses. Facts which have solid evidence behind them. Facts which are as true as any other fact in history. Jesus rose, and in rising, he has opened the way through death for anyone else to follow him, if only they will hang on to his coattails by faith. That's the first strand for us to consider, a new fact, the resurrection of Jesus. And then as we finish, a second strand, a new meaning, the work of Jesus. Because 1 Corinthians 15, verse 58, that last verse, doesn't leave us with just a bald fact and then nothing to do. It tells us rather of the hope we have, a hope which should transform our lives in this world. Always give yourselves to the work of, fully to the work of the Lord, he says, because he knows your labor in the Lord is not in vain. In the book of Ecclesiastes, we were thinking about earlier, the word vanity comes up a lot. And vanity means not vanity in the sense of looking in a mirror for a long time, but vanity in the sense of it is vain or passing. It is transient. And the writer to the Ecclesiastes found, when he thought about it, everything is passing. There is nothing that lasts in this world. It is fleeting. But here the Apostle Paul says there is one thing that is not vanity. There is one thing that does last beyond this world, and that is the work of the Lord. His work in this world to bring people to faith in him and then to build up those people in faith in him. the effort you invest in that direction will bear fruit into eternity. I'm afraid it is an uncomfortable truth that everything we do in our jobs during the day, in the end, will not last. Not say it has no value, it just doesn't have an eternal value, doesn't have a lasting value. Its value is restricted to this life. But the work of the Lord has a value into eternity. I don't have time this morning to explore this more fully, except to alert us to the possibility that those who follow Jesus Christ and commit themselves to his ways, those who reorder their priorities in this life, will find that they have the joy of living a purposeful life which bears fruit into eternity. This is what we were made for. Jesus Christ came into this world to restore us to the relationship we were made to have with the living God who made us to know him, so that when we know him, we might then serve him as he made us to do. And if you're not sure where you stand with Jesus Christ this morning, I simply want to encourage you, therefore, not to turn from him, not to turn your back on him, not to live for what everyone else is living for, which in the end we will find is a dead end, but rather to be open to receive from him what he came into this world to offer you, peace with the living God, so that you might now live a purposeful life in service of the God who first served you by dying for you. Let me suggest a couple of things you could do to take this further. One is to come to Christianity Explored, as I said, Tuesday nights, 7:30 at Berwick Street. You don't have to say anything, you can just sit there and listen, or you can ask absolutely any question you wanted to. Nothing is a problem. Why don't you come and actually invest a bit of time? It will cost you 6 evenings, no money, but 6 evenings to consider this important topic for yourself. That would be one way to do something about it. Another way would be to take a copy of this. We've got copies on the table at the back. They are free to you, and it's only 60 pages of very small pages for you to have a look at. A Summary of the Christian Faith by Rico Tice. It's called Capturing God, and I commend that to you. The only thing I think you should not do is nothing, which, of course, is the easiest thing to do, to walk out of here and realize that life carries on, to put this all on the back burner and pretend that death is tomorrow's issue. But really, it isn't. It's today's issue. I urge you not to make the mistake of thinking there will be a better day to look into this than the day God has given you today. Moment of quiet, and then I'll lead us in a prayer. Let's bow our heads. A moment of quiet to consider individually where we stand before God this morning. Our Heavenly Father, you alone knows the heart and the mind of each person here this morning. And I pray that you would search our hearts, search our consciences, that we might not turn our backs on you. Please have mercy on us. We heard earlier, Lord, of someone who found that you were willing to give a second chance, a third chance. We know your mercy is available for any who want it. So I pray that even this morning you would draw individuals here who are keeping you at arm's length to a living faith in Jesus. In whose name we pray. Amen.